Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we'll hear a talk by Young Zhou, Presidential Chairman and Associate Dean for Global Education at the University of Oregon, and author of World Class Learners, Educating Creative and Entrepreneurial Students. His topic will be Catching Up or Leading the Way, American Education in the Age of Globalization. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 18, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the sponsors of the E.N. Thompson Forum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is Lloyd Ambrosius, Samuel Clark Waugh, Distinguished Professor of International Relations and Professor of History at the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and Chairman of the Program Committee of the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues.
This evening's lecture, Catching Up or Leading the Way, American Education in the Age of Globalization, is by Young Zhou. He is an internationally recognized scholar on the impacts of globalization and technology on education. He currently serves as Presidential Chair and Associate Dean for Global Education at the University of Oregon, where he is also a Weinman Professor of Technology and a professor in the Department of Educational Measurement, Policy, and Leadership. He is a winner of the Early Career Award from the American Educational Research Association. Now join me in welcoming Young Zhou to Nebraska.
Good evening. It's great to be in Nebraska. It's a state you can't really avoid when you want to cross the country. So it's really beautiful to be here. Several years ago, when I was running different organizational conferences, I discovered a very interesting phenomenon. That is, China was reforming its education to be more like America, and America was reforming its education to be more like China. So that was very interesting, that kind of paradox, and I think both countries want to end up in Hawaii, and that's the paradise of education. So first of all, let's start with a very tough question for you to think about, a question that has to do with American education reforms. You know, America has been doing a lot of reforms over the last 2 to 3 decades, led by national level. We have changed the nation's education landscape in the U.S., from No Child Left Behind to George, and that's George Bush, if you remember him, still, I don't know, to Obama's Race to the Top. You know, you realize this idea about the issue with both major national initiatives is the question about where we want to go. You know, when No Child Left Behind was started, I'm still working on something like No Child Left Behind in what? Sometimes you want your children to be left behind, you know. In some places are nice than going there. And with Obama's initiative, the idea of a Race to the Top is completely against my Chinese Taoist belief. You know, you never want to go to the top too fast. Because once you get to the top, the only place you can go is going down. That's not very nice. And if I were Obama, I would say crawl to the top and take another 50 years. However, actually in this country, I observe the Republicans and Democrats agree on one issue, how to destroy our public education. If you think about that, I'm always imagining Obama secretly working together with George Bush. And so Obama said, George says no child is left behind. Obama says, let's race to the top and push them off the cliff. Mission accomplished. That's what they call. Now, the question, this major education change has actually to do with a bigger concern of Americans losing its competitive edge in the age of globalization. We're seeing other countries, you know, surpassing us. You know, Obama keeps talking about we have to out-educate other countries, out-compete other countries. So you hear this every day, people talking about how American education is getting worse, is in decline. So I'll start with the first question. Major question for you to think about is the idea that what makes a great education and is American education truly, truly changing a lot? So the big question we know in the U.S. is this one. I want to ponder this question. Why is America still here? I mean, this is not only a Canadian question. It's the Canadians want to know, but it's an American question. It's that, why are we still here? And as I said, we think, we are told each day, American education is in decline, is getting worse. But historical data would show that American education is not in decline, is not getting worse. It has always been bad. It has been bad for a long time. For those of you who remember, 1958, that's the year after 1957. That's why it's important. 1957 was important because that's the year the first man-made satellite, Sputnik, was launched by the Soviet Union. And the Life magazine had a special cover story showing how much worse American education was compared to that in the Soviet Union, with two students on the cover. One is student, American student from Chicago. One is Alexei from Moscow. I don't have to tell you which one is American, which one is a Russian, and because the American student is smiling too much. By the way, according to the article, American education that makes Stephen happy is the one that's going to doom America's future, because we do not, or we did not, have rigorous curriculum, high expectations, and Stephen was playing too much with his girlfriends. That was the idea. And Alex in Moscow had a much rigorous curriculum, focused on science, does only high-class, you know, games like chess. And that was actually a very interesting time to observe this. Of course, this then changed. In the end, Soviet Union doesn't exist. And I think Alex moved to the U.S. and Stephen became an engineer afterwards. No, as many years. So it's an interesting story. But that's just one time. In terms of our measurement, test scores, in 1964, the first international mathematics study showed Americans' 12th graders ranked 12th out of 12 countries. Now, that's pretty bad. If you do math, right? And we were basically at the bottom. And that's 12 countries out of the Western democratic countries. If you remember the time, that's the Cold War. So the other countries did not participate. Then after that, we had SIMS, Second International Mathematics Study. Then we had TIMSS, Third International Mathematics Science Study, or now we call TRANS, International Mathematics Science Study. All of the studies show that America never had a good old day in education, measured by test scores. So we've had bad education for over half a century. You think if education mattered, if test scores measured quality of education, America should not be here. That's why I raised the question that America, why is America still here? America is not only still here. According to President Obama, in his State of Union address in 2011, America still has the largest, most prosperous economy in the world, which, by the way, actually is true. It is factual, at least more factual than some of his other facts. So how do you explain this? Interesting to think about. So that's the biggest question I want you to ponder about. What measures as good education? And recently, of course, China has risen to be the star of education. So the second question I raise is that why didn't China have a big party? This is not the Communist Party, which is actually quite large, and this is a celebration party that is to celebrate China's achievement. You know how eager the Chinese Communist Party is to celebrate any international achievement, but not in this one. This was the results of the release data of PISA in 2009. For the first time, China participated in any major international studies for the mainland students. PISA is the assessment of 15-year-olds. It's run by OECD, and it's the largest international academic horse race. So it's a test, 15-year-olds, three subjects, run by every 3 years. China, for the first time, students from Shanghai participated, and students from Shanghai took number one in every category. And China repeated the same success last year, still number one in all categories. And there's a top 10. By the way, if you want to look for the U.S., your screen is too small. I cannot put it there. You can't find it. So this is supposed to be a major achievement. And indeed, many outside observers think this is a big achievement. They think China has done everything right in education. A great writer, Thomas Friedman, a member of Word of Class, and the word is flat, talked on NBC and said, "I wish we could be China for a day." That was Thomas Friedman's admiration. And in education, we have Secretary of Education Arne Duncan called this a wake-up call, a major wake-up call in his press release. And by the way, Arne Duncan has received many wake-up calls, but he refuses to wake up. That's the problem. Is that President Obama called this a Sputnik moment. That is to indicate how serious this is. And then you have a group of researchers led by Mark Tucker, the president and CEO of the National Center for Education and the Economy, put together a book that was published by Harvard Education Press called Surpassing Shanghai. That's the American's agenda for education reform. So Shanghai become the America's national goal. Which, by the way, this book really annoyed me a lot when we first came out, because I thought I moved to the wrong country. If I stayed in China, I would have been default number one. You know, it was. But more annoying to me when I examine the history of American education is that we have been driven by this inferiority complex since 1980s. 1983, a nation at risk. Should American education is behind others, at that time Korea and Japan. And this time we want to surpass Shanghai, which makes American education goals get smaller and smaller and smaller. I actually blame this on President Bush. And President Bush, in No Child Left Behind, you guys notice that a major goal of No Child Left Behind with massive reform was to make sure every third grader can read. For the most developed country on earth, making reading illiteracy a national goal is just silly. But, you know, we get all this silly goal lowering our expectations. Think about this. Not only us, by the way. The Australians began to admire Asian countries. They talk about the Grattan Institute out of University of Melbourne put together a major summit, which actually I was invited there to moderate, to say, we got to learn from East Asian countries, Shanghai, Singapore, Korea, and Hong Kong. And because students from Shanghai are 2 years ahead in math by the time they reach 15 years, that's a lot if you think about it. This looks like interesting data. They all want to learn from Shanghai. By the way, there's another, in America, Shanghai or China has become the new Soviet Union or the new Japan to drive reforms. There's a governor called Ed Rendell out of Pennsylvania. I don't know if you're in Nebraska, you notice there is a state called Pennsylvania on the other side. And they have a governor, two-term governor, Ed Rendell, was really funny. And 1 year, just shortly after the release of the data, there was a game, that was a football game, was canceled. I think it was the Philadelphia Eagles due to a snowstorm. And you think football game, China, they had nothing to do with each other. But somehow the governor got something together. He went on public radio and chastised all the Philadelphians, Pennsylvanians, and NFL organizers. This is what he said. He said, "We've become a nation of wussies. The Chinese are kicking our butt in everything. If this was in China, do you think the Chinese would have called off the game? People would have been marching down to the stadium. And they would have walked and they would have been doing calculus on their way down." By the way, I don't that doesn't happen. First off, the Chinese would not even go to the game. And they would be doing calculus in their dorm. So that's and in England, it's another thing. England, Secretary of Education Michael Gove of the new government went to China to learn how China got so good. And he went home and wrote in a telegraph, said, "I am happy to confess I'd like us to implement a cultural revolution just like the one they've had in China, We need some history lesson for him. But like Chairman Mao, we've embarked on a long march to reform our education system. And you know that England, their Minister of Education just went to China, and they are importing 60 Chinese math teachers to help solve England's math problem. So everybody loved China's education achievement and celebrated on Chinese behalf, except the Chinese. I was there. I was there when the data was released, and the Chinese government, the Chinese massively observers, most people did not celebrate because, as the previous premier of China, Wen Jiabao, said, we need Steve Jobs, not test takers. And that actually prompts many discussion about this. And so Chinese people began to ask, how come a nation of 1.3 billion people, four times the size of U.S. population, by even random distribution, China should have four times the number of baby Steve Jobs born? What happened to the baby Steve Jobs? That's a question, interesting to ponder, right? To think of. And then another question is Kai-Fu Lee, who was actually an executive at Microsoft, Apple, then led the Google in China. Then he got out of the position, run one of the first venture capitalists to stimulate venture capital firms to stimulate IT innovation in China. He himself was immigrant from Taiwan, went to school at in Tennessee, and then got his degree from, I think, Columbia and Carnegie Mellon. And he knows both systems very well. He said in a very public forum something very controversial. He said the next Google and Apple will emerge for sure, but probably not in China, probably not even in Asia, unless they abandon or abolish their education system. So the same thing would happen is that in China, for example, China basically recently you've seen a rise in the number of patents, filings, applications, rise of publications all over the world. You think their capacity is high, but high-quality patents still do not exist. True major disruptive innovation patents don't exist. So the data would show that China was 20% of the world's population, 9%, actually now it's about 13% now, of world's GDP, and 12% of the R&D expenditure, only 1% of patent finance granted by leading offices out of China, not within China. And that's a very sad statement. So this, you have it. The U.S., despite its 60 years of education, poor quality, and still remains here. And China, despite all of this major achievement, is having trouble with the creativity. So how do we explain any of this? Well, it has to do with what we mean by education. It is, what do you mean by education? So I have come up with this idea about talking about educational side effects. The side effects that explains that when you achieve something, you will lose something. So we have this model called a paradigm of education. This is the traditional education paradigm we have been following every place, in the U.S. and other places. So it is what I call a sausage-making model. Because if you imagine all your schools, universities do the same thing, right? We describe the outcomes. We try to make a guess. What works in the future? What will make you employable? What will make you valuable? That's what we call the core curriculum. We describe that. Then we make school. All schooling is about making sure children acquire those things. Then we use assessment. We test those things. So the end results is how well students have mastered what have been prescribed. And also in the same process, since it's a sausage maker, we do not want people who do not want to become sausages. Remember, it's a homogenization machine. That's right. And so we call individual differences, diversity, they're all problems for schools. Remember your school, your students, if they're different, we say they're not ready for kindergarten. Remember those things? Is that so? We try to do those things. It's like in Nebraska, you know this. You know, different cuts of meat are pretty good, you know, in their own rights.
a ribeye steak is good to be a ribeye steak. But what if you get some crazy people say, we only want sausages? We want what kind of granite? Just grind the ribeye into sausages. That's what we do. We take all the people. You know, you may be great. Music, art, thinking, but we don't like you. So this model has been practiced for a long, long time. It works fine. It works on the condition that, number one, we know pretty sure what skills, what knowledge we will need in the future. That's what we call the curriculum. And America has always had trouble with this. We think about Asian countries have high test scores because they have a narrow, deep, focused curriculum. That's why in this country we are trying to copy that. We'll have a national curriculum through something called the Common Core. State standards. By the way, congratulations for not adopting that in Nebraska. And the Common Core basically prescribes what we think will be valuable. It's a national bet. We are betting on behalf of millions of children that if you acquire this, you will be ready for college and career. And that's why we admire those countries who can do it. We have that thing. The more successful you are at homogenized people, through a national standardized curriculum, through nationalized high-stakes testing, you will have better test results. That's no question about this thing. So you are better to homogenize that process. And this was almost necessary for an old society. The old society were, you know, a closed economy, you can predict what you need. But also in the old society, we did not have a lot of need for great talents. Because most people worked on jobs created by a few great people. You know, when I lived in Michigan, I know you were going to work for Henry Ford or General Motors. Those few great people created millions of jobs that require similar skills and knowledge. And those great people typically were not products of our education system. So in a traditional society, great people with different talents are not very useful unless they can create this a massive number of jobs. I can tell you, I was born in a village in China. I grew up there as well, in Sichuan province, all farmers and peasants and all those things. I can tell you in my village that Lady Gaga would be useless. And so would Steve Jobs, actually, for that matter. I mean, all those things. So that's what we were preparing. And the challenge is this. And when the more successful you are at homogenized people, the less likely they're going to create something. The less likely they're going to become entrepreneurial. That's very, very, very interesting. And so American education has been what I call a broken sausage maker that made some bacon. And it is those bacon that saved America for a long time. China is the perfect sausage maker. Their problem is when societies change, we need different people. American average lose 1 million jobs a year because of closed down of companies. But luckily, we have people to help us make all those transitions. Over the last 60 years, you know, we've done a lot of transition. And today, however, we face a big challenge. Americans' traditional education strength, you know, we are very diverse. We allow public funding and public provision. That's key. We do not select people based on their test scores into our 12 years of education. We do not select based on their race. They all had a chance to do this. And that means we do not run a country club system. We did not test you, make you like me. So everybody had a chance in the system. That preserved some of our great, great bacon. That's like Steve Jobs. You can drop out. You know, one of the things I want Americans to be better than most other education system is our students' talent shows. Have you seen those talent shows? It's amazing. Some of them you can barely call talent, but they get a show. You know, you get to see that. That's why we celebrate diversity. We allow everyone the same chance. The second thing America has a chance to do is this open and forgiving system. America has one of the most forgiving education systems, which looks really snobby. You know, on the outside, because we are, if you failed kindergarten, you can go to first grade. If you failed fifth grade, you can go to sixth grade. If you failed high school, you get a GED. We got something for you, everybody, right? So that's, you go out there, and that really is beautiful. Because in many ways, you know, if you fail a child at kindergarten, you drop the creativity, you drop confidence. And I'm sure many of you still did things that you haven't told your parents yet. Allow people to forgive. Youthful transgressions allow you to explore possibilities. It's very important. It's like my son's first grade teacher, Mrs. Marge Lippe, Michigan, told me once, said that I really believe children like popcorn. You know, in Nebraska, you should understand this one. It's about popcorn. I said, how so? She said, well, some pop early and some pop late. And eventually, they were all pop. I said, yeah, but, you know, there are a few who get burned. But, you know, other than those, it's a... but other than those, you know, we'll be fine. But that is allowing people to develop in their own way. It's very important when you tie this. And now, of course, another major thing is talk about local control, decentralized. America, another one, the beauty of America as a government, we do not have a national system. We do not have one national government. We don't even have one local government. We have many, many governments. In one time, we got over 200,000 school districts. They're independent governments. Now we have about 13,000 school districts. They are their own government. Unfortunately, remember, in order to become the best sausage maker, we're imposing national curriculum. We have basically taken away all the local decision-making power in curriculum, assessment, teachers, and autonomy from teachers to centralize. Most local school districts in this country now has become a federal government branch, implementing what Washington wants, what other state wants. And those local decision-making is very powerful because when you have 14,000 school districts, even half of them fail, you get another half successful. If you had one system, if your bet is wrong, everybody fails. So the beauty of this country is this decentralized local government control. Again, we're losing all of those. So these are the traditional virtues that created America's accident. But by definition, they make America as a horrible country to homogenize. We have too many different opinions, too many curriculum, and too many views. That's the beauty of this system. And now we're trying to close that. But I have to say, America so far has been fortunate because the creativity and the entrepreneurs who have been create the company to help America survive all the ups and downs over the past half century, and we're losing a lot of those things. And those things have been accidental, by the way, is that by design, we are not there yet. So I have come to the decision that America does not teach creativity any better than China or other Asian countries. We do not kill it as successfully as those guys. We have failed to kill them, but not by design. We have not cultivated them. But the problem is we are facing big challenges today. Well, technology always redefines the value of talents. Today, we are facing some very serious challenges in our education. So we have to be systematic and think about what's next. So let me show you some of the problems. One of the problems is that our education has, in general, failed our students. In the U.S. now, we've got over half of recent college graduates are jobless or underemployed. You know what? With all the data with today's race to the top, with the Common Core talking about college and career readiness, you can be ready for college, but unless we change, we're going to have a trouble. So for me, because I have two children, I have a daughter and I have a son, I'm always concerned about something else, not about college readiness. If you are simply ready for college, like my son was, he was so ready that he was able to get into one of the most expensive universities in the country, but he was not so ready, he did not get any money for it. So I got to pay. As many people you know, as middle class in America, you never want to be in the middle, okay? That's the in as middle class, I was telling some people this afternoon that I'm a professor. I make enough money not to qualify for any financial assistance for his tuition, but I do not make enough that I don't care about the money he pays. And so it was a horrible situation. So he graduated and he majored in art. You know, it's very long Chinese, but he did. And so one of the things is that it's not about college readiness. For him, my criteria of his education was that, can you stay out of my basement? So I call this, education has to make children out of the basement ready. That means to be independent, financially independent, psychologically independent, and socially independent. So, but our education so far has failed in recent years that we have so many college students in their parents' basement. And on average, they have a college debt of $23,000. And this is a global phenomenon. It's not American phenomena. It's we have Korea problem. China's graduating over 7 million college students this year. 7 million college students this year. European countries, we have even bigger problems. You know, youth unemployment in Europe has caused a lot of these unstable situations. And this is not because of the financial crisis. That's true. You know, that's many years ago now. 2008, European countries actually had worse unemployment situation for youth in 2012 than in 2008. And today, you know, the stock market is actually going up in the U.S. The companies are investing more, and we're not growing jobs in this country. Why is that? Then we have another problem. That is, a lot of our children today, even when they have a job, they are working on jobs that do not require a college graduation. You know, that's why we should be proud or we should be sad. In the U.S. today, we have a generation of best-educated bartenders. Really. I mean, if you try it, I was working somewhere actually there. The cocktails taste better when it's prepared by chemistry majors. Sad, right? In Walmart, Starbucks, a lot of them. But at the same time, we have a major paradox to deal with. That is, we have a global talent shortage. Companies around the globe cannot find enough talents to work for them. So this is the thing. Unemployed college graduates, overqualified on jobs, and at the same time, we have companies not finding the right talents. What is wrong with this picture? Well, the society has just changed. We want bacons and other things other than sausages. Technology has always redefined the value of talents. Human beings have all kinds of knowledge. We always ask the question, what knowledge, what talent is of value? It's worth teaching. In 1860s, there was a British philosopher called Herbert Spencer who wrote one of the most influential essays in education titled, What Knowledge is of Most Worth? That time was trying to redefine the value of school curriculum. Because at that time, most schools were teaching Latin and Greek. So if we did Common Core at that time, that would be Latin and Greek. And his argument says that that's not important anymore. We live in an industrial society. Science, technology will be important. That's the beginning of our modern curriculum, teaching modern sciences. That's 150 years ago. That's 150. Today, we live in a different society. So what kind of situation are we now in? Well, we're in a very bad situation. The bad situation starts with Obama's State of Union address talked about. That is the disappearance of the middle class in the U.S. You see, in the last 30 years, the middle income bracket has dropped from some 60% to 40%. Then we see the growth of, we have a bipolar growth. The top income and bottom income is growing. America's bedrock, the middle class, is disappearing. The economy is hollowing out. What happened? And what has changed? Well, something very simple. Something you can look over the last 200 years, the change of jobs in proportion, what's growing, what's not. The green line shows something very simple. 200 years ago, we got a massive in the middle class, most people worked in farming. fishing, forestry. Then that's replaced by manufacturing and other kind of workers. And then starting in the 1970s, we began to lose those jobs. To whom? What happened? Well, the first thing that happened to most of us to think about is automation. We used to have a lot of people making middle-class income on this, and today, it's gone. It happens. Millions of jobs replaced. And not only manufacturing, because of computer chips are replacing our cognitive abilities. Now, when I first came to this country, we had a lot of H&R block accountants doing taxes in shopping malls. Do you see them anymore? They have been replaced by TurboTax. They're banking teller, bank tellers. And look at lawyers. This is actually my fun fact, is that America has a surplus of lawyers. This is shocking to many people. We are still suing each other as much as possible, but we don't need as many lawyers. Why? Search engines. You don't need so many people to do legal cases, to review these books. You can find them on your fingertip. Has massively changed. We also see another thing about results of globalization since 1970s, because transportation costs much less, now we can send jobs to other places. And the first groups of jobs were shoemaking, or t-shirts, textile, to other countries. Now we're outsourcing other so-called high-end jobs. Computer programming, financing, customer services, all those things. So we are seeing a major shift. Almost, we're going to see more jobs taken away. In the future, if a job can be analyzed into steps, it will be automated or sent out overseas. So by the way, here are some of the jobs that may be replaced or may not be replaced. So high skills, non-substitutable jobs as nursing, teaching, office work. So you can, if you're a teacher, you have a job forever. Well, not if people began import teachers from China, that's going to replace you. And now, all of this has created interesting situation. That is, we see two classes rising: the creative class and the service class. People in the creative sector are the high-income people. They're growing fast. And we're seeing the service sector is growing fast. They're low-income people. So that's our challenge. We have no traditional middle-class jobs anymore. And those creative people who used to create a lot of jobs don't create jobs anymore. Like Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, for example, that's three times the size of General Motors. It hires a very few people, 6,000 people. Apple Computers, the wealthiest company in the world, hire about 43,000 workers in the U.S. They don't. They're not Henry Ford anymore. They do not create jobs. So the traditional, we wanted to create jobs to become employees, to be hired by those people, they don't exist anymore. So now we need to figure out who is the new middle class. Schools have to focus on creating new middle class. And the new middle class is actually, you can see this then, has to be the creative class. Creativity used to be reserved for a few people. Today, creativity has become necessity. Creativity is job security. Americans just happen to have a few by accident, but we need everybody to be creative. But schools have not been used to cultivating creative people. Schools, actually, by definition, when I was showing the sausage making, is we actually try to kill creativity. Creativity as a concept was not even talked about until after the 1920s. By the way, this is Google Books. Number of mentions of creativity in all the Google Books. And the writings about creativity began to rise after the 1980s when we realized that everybody has to become creative. We call today in the U.S. is not information economy, it's a creativity economy. If you can create something, new ideas have to pop up. Schools were designed in the old paradigm to stifle creativity because we don't like kids like this. Remember, we call them not school ready. You know, remember those guys, you know, not kindergarten ready. They do not follow. And that's why most of the time children are born creative. At age five, 98% of our children are creative
at a genius level, 98%. By the time they finish 5 years of elementary school and kindergarten, we've successfully got rid of 60% of them. Age 10, our children, about 32% are creative at the same level. By the time they finish middle school, age 15, 10% are left. Remember, we have the fourth grade slump. Everybody reaches that. Around fourth grade, when schools become serious, become more formal, children have the slump in creativity. And actually now it's getting worse. I'm sure with the Obama's kindergarten testing, with a lot of assessment in starting kindergarten, we will lose even more of that. That's why we have this big alliance talk about the idea of crisis in creativity, which has been documented by a lot of people in recent years, that there was a major shift of our thinking. And so now, by the way, I want to show you this. You get a chance. Your creativity can come back after retirement. George Bush is painting now. Just think about that. So, how do we reverse this trend? Because all schools were designed to make sausages. We need to change that. The second part is that we live in a new age too. In this new age, another element of the new middle class are those people who were traditionally useless. Traditionally useless people have become useful, like Kim Kardashian. You may not agree, but Kardashian is out of her parents' basement. I use Kardashian as an example, very, very simple, because to show you that we now live in a society, we consume different products and services. In the 21st century in the U.S. now, we have entered the age called the age of abundance. In the age of abundance versus the age of necessity, we consume different products and services. The age of necessity, we consume things that was necessary for survival. 100 years ago, we spent most of our income on necessities, housing, food, and shelter. Today, we spend less than half of our income on those things. We spend the rest on useless stuff. What are those things called useless, unnecessary? Choice. 21st century, we consume choices. And when I first came to this country, out of a village of necessity, I came to the U.S., I could not buy shampoo to wash my hair because I did not know what kind of hair I had. I got to find the right thing, the right shampoo. But those choices are necessary. In the U.S., if you have no choice, you are very unhappy. Do you know that? Is a choice necessary? How many flavors of potato chips we had? Seriously, did you notice those things? How many TV channels do you have? How many cooking shows do you have? I couldn't believe people. There's a dedicated channel for poker games, What's the value of that? Isn't that worse than Kim Kardashian? And in restaurants, the more money you pay, the less food you get. What are you consuming? You're consuming psychological products. So we talk personalization, psychological, and spiritual products. We have a new profession now in the U.S. called life coaches. We don't know how to live without life coaches anymore. My father, who is a peasant, still lives in my village, 85, is fine without life coach. He's fine. Where do we have those things? Because we live in the age of abundance. In the age of abundance, the traditionally undervalued talents have become valuable. Dyslexia has always been considered a problem because it interferes with reading. That's why we call it a disability. But dyslexia recently has been discovered to be an advantage. Dyslexic people have a different neuron wiring that allows them to perceive patterns, 3D patterns, better than most of us. So they make the best astrophysicist. They make the best artist, 3D designers. But 100 years ago, there's not many jobs for those guys. If you can see the skies very well, only one profession that's called witches, you don't get much job. And so today, they can become artists. They can become video game designers. They have become an asset. Don't fix them.
bring them over here. So the square peg does not have to fit in the round hole. So 21st century, the second element of new middle class is traditionally undervalued talents have become valuable in the hyper-specialized economy. Anyone who has any talent can develop with great to a level of greatness will become very valuable, stay out of parents' basement. That's basic. If Lady Gaga is useful, anyone can be useful. The third element is most of our schools miss is the idea of entrepreneurism, entrepreneurial spirit. Traditionally, we've been talking about entrepreneurs as people who make money, engage in transactions. I call them business entrepreneurs. But actually today, we need social entrepreneurs who start social enterprises to solve social problems. We also need intrapreneurs. Those are the jobs that in America, in other countries, they couldn't find people to fill. The short talent shortage. They were looking for intrapreneurs, not employees. They were looking for people at Apple Computer, for example. They said, if you want to be managed, you are not employable. But we kept producing, you know, people want to be managed, looking for jobs. Remember those kinds? That's employees. And we need policy entrepreneurs. That's another thing. Policy entrepreneurs means those are, we call them traditional bureaucrats or politicians. We do not need entrepreneur policy thinkers. You know, a few weeks ago, government was shut down in the federal government, and there's a lot of complaints. So America has too many different opinions. We got too many parties, Tea Party, Coffee Party, all kinds of parties. They have different views. And America is built to have different views. But we need it. Entrepreneur-thinking policy makers or politicians who will negotiate with each other, who would compromise, not like Obama and Congress. They're like five-year-olds. Actually, that's an insult to five-year-olds. And, you know, do you notice that Congress, when the government shut down, Obama said, I'm not talking to you. You're not coming to my birthday party, you know, tonight. We need them to negotiate. That's entrepreneur thinking. So what makes entrepreneurs different from employees? Entrepreneurs look at problems as opportunities. Entrepreneurs come up with solutions. Entrepreneurs are persistent and resilient. Even their ideas do not work, they will try something different. Employees don't. Employees wait for orders, wait for solutions to implement. They're not intrinsically motivated, they're extrinsically motivated. We need entrepreneur spirit. That's something our schools are missing. Our schools teach employees. So that's why our students come to ask you, what do I have to do to get an A? Remember? So what do you really want to do? Do you mean 15 pages or 30 pages? Double-spaced? Do you remember those questions you feel all the time? I've been teaching for some 25, 30 years. That's the question really annoys me. I said, however long you want to write. I don't even care. Why would I care? It's your learning. Think about that. It's very sad. We train our people to treat us as their boss and give them a grade because we cultivate the employee mindset. It's not about their learning. They should become entrepreneur. So what makes entrepreneur qualities? Confidence, social networking, friends, risk-taking, passion, and creativity. All of this, going back to the sausage-making model, the more effective you are as a sausage maker, the more likely you're going to decrease all of this. These non-cognitive skills, hard-to-measure thinking attributes, are never considered major part of our education. In our schools, only some schools take care of this. But most schools, only when you are in trouble academically, we begin to talk about your social-emotional interest. But social-emotional interests have become most valuable. Today, the most valuable skills are not academic skills, actually. Are your thinking, your creativity, entrepreneur, are you confident, all those things. And social abilities, the undervalued talents have risen to be very important. But the problem is that, as I was talking about, every education has side effects, as medicine. When you go buy Tylenol, it tells you, whoa, this might cause bleeding stomach while curing your runny nose. In education, have you ever received that warning label from your school, policymakers, or publications? I can tell you they do. Because education, as any human phenomena, when it cures, it poisons. When you get something, you lose something. When you get good test scores, you drop something. For example, I know, as an early reading researcher, I know some reading programs should have a warning label to tell you this. This may improve your children's test scores in reading, but may cause your children to hate reading forever. We know that. So here's some big data for you to think about. I just showed you the different tests. All international tests now have a non-cognitive aspect. Americans' media only reports the cognitive aspect. So in 2003, TIMSS, Trends in International Mathematics Study, that's the third one out of 1964, that's first international mathematics study. The T used to be third, but they like the brand, so they changed third into T. As usual, Americans, eighth graders, fourth graders, scored way below Asian students in math. On the same study, they asked another question about confidence. Said, I believe I usually do well in math. That's the question. Children said, strongly agree, agrees a lot, agrees a little, disagrees a little, disagrees a lot. So you can imagine American students, they may be mathematically challenged or stupid, but they are very confident. American students out-confident everybody. So here's the puzzle we researchers deal with. Countries that produce high test scores in math have lower confidence and lower enjoyment. It's a global phenomenon. Do you value confidence? Do you value test scores? This is not only one time. It is actually happens all the time. 2011, we have another TIMSS study repeated. All the East Asian countries look at test scores, math scores. They're over 100 points higher than Americans and Australians and the Brits. But if you look at the confidence scores in the third column and the value scores, they are much lower. So looking at this data, Americans come to different conclusions. On the one hand, they said, okay, my God, our students have high confidence but low test scores, which means they are too confident, too happy for their own good. Well, they're so happy, but they're so bad because they just don't know how bad they are. Why don't they know how bad they are? Because we have lower standards. So Americans since 1990s, we've been bringing higher standards in math, standards-driven accountability measures, all of this, the time, trying to do that. We want to make sure our children know they're bad, and so they can. They're not worse than their friends, but they're worse than people in countries they don't even know existed. Asian countries took a different interpretation. After all those test scores, Japan worried about their children have no enthusiasm in science. Hong Kong students was number one in reading, but half of their children have no interest in reading. Singapore worried about students' lack of confidence. And Finland, many people talk about Finland. Finland was number one on the PISA score in science, but Finnish students have no interest in science. If you have no interest, you're not going to become a scientist. And PISA scores has a strong negative correlation with entrepreneur activities in every country. Countries with higher math scores or reading scores on the PISA have lower entrepreneurship confidence, activities, and general behavior in entrepreneur thinking. So this is the side effects. What do we want? You want to become the best sausage maker or you want to expand? So for the future, to keep our children out of our basement, America cannot continue to rely on the accident we had. We have to move forward. America cannot benchmark its future to the past. When we try to learn from China, we're benchmarking to the past. America is worried about China surpassing it in the future. Do you know America? China surpassed America before there was an America. 1776. At that time, China was the largest economy for almost 2,000 years. Almost. Why did not the founding fathers benchmark to China at that time? I don't know. You know, if the founding fathers were interested in global benchmarking, they would have benchmarked to China or England at that time. They didn't. They invented a system. Today, education, we need a different future. We cannot copy something in the past. America has always been about inventing, making new things. So the past 20 years of education reform has lost our traditional virtues, wasted our time without inventing the future. Today, I encourage us to invent the future by moving to a new paradigm. A new paradigm that emphasizes on people's strength. Education ultimately is about enhancing our strength, not fix their deficit. It's not about imposing a national curriculum, but to support a personal curriculum. It is not about homogenizing individuals, it's about diversifying individuals. In the future, if your children can be curious, can ask questions, not answering questions, can create new ideas or new forms of things, can look at the globe as opportunities, not as competition, we will have a happy future for everybody. So what I define the future success of education is we need creative, entrepreneur students who are globally competent and who capitalize on their own individual interest, their own passion-driven. And entrepreneurs are, in essence, people who care about other people's needs and drive the whole thing. So just to show you how we have been making mistakes about technology and about globalization, we have basically been looking at losses of the past as problems. So politics in this country is always about preserving the past. Though now they let jobs go. Michigan has been trying to make cars forever. They did not realize the Stone Age did not end because they ran out of stones. They still think we can make cars. You know, Michigan lost that battle. The only reason Michigan is still making cars is because basically they want to make sure people can run away from it as fast as possible. That's the only. Now, what we need is to rethink about education. Globalize, if we want to compete with any country, if that's the goal, we cannot compete in test scores. Even if we did have produced the same test scores as China, as Korea, it would have cost us $10,000 to produce test scores. And that's, but in China, that may only cost $100. That's already lost. We have to educate in a different pathway. That's why America has to do personalized education, global competence, view the rising Asia, Brazil, Russia as new market. We need to create something to help them understand. What do you have to do to build a new education system? America has the resources. America has the cultural tradition. America has the will. We got to invent. Inventing the future means our schools have a personalized education experience, move to product-oriented learning, and take advantage of the globalized campus idea. And to make all of this happen, to keep your kids out of your basement, the only thing you need to do is just read my book. Solves all the problem, okay? So thank you very much. Keep the kids out of our basement. Make them independent. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the E.N. Thompson Forum on World Issues on Noon Forum. The E.N. Thompson Forum is co-sponsored by the Cooper Foundation, the LEAD Center, and the University of Nebraska at Lincoln. Today we've heard a talk by Yong Zhou, Presidential Chairman and Associate Dean for Global Education at the University of Oregon, and author of World Class Learners, Educating Creative and Entrepreneurial Students. His topic was Catching Up or Leading the Way, American Education in the Age of Globalization. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, March 18, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Katie Cervantes, E.N. Thompson Forum Coordinator, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 400 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.